On this episode of Still Loading, we're going Russian. Hey guys, it's Josh, and welcome back to this new episode of Still Loading. For this week's episode, we are going to be talking about the NES game Tetris. Once again, I know we've been so focused on the Nintendo Entertainment System, but we're almost at the end of the 40 for 40 series, guys. Thank you so much for coming along this ride with me. I do plan on doing a lot more different types of games, like I've said in the last couple episodes, but trust me, I already have some episodes lined up. Not recorded yet, but I have ideas, so let's continue on. Like I said, we're covering Tetris today for the NES. And while there isn't much to say about the game itself, there is a lot to actually talk about in terms of the history. Now, before we go into the history, that's in true Still Loading style, let's talk about the box art. And the box art's pretty freaking awesome. It's got this awesome blue background with all these, with all the blocks that you're used to from Tetris, you know, dropping from the sky. And it looks pretty freaking cool. It's got, this motion blur effect, so it appears like they're going really fast. And on the back, it says, Tetris, the Soviet game sensation. Your pulse quickens. Beams, boxes, zigzags, and L-shapes. L-shaped building blocks drop relentlessly down a narrow passage. You quickly spin, shift, and align the shapes, then slide them down for a perfect fit. And there's more to it. I don't really feel like reading all of it. But in any case, the box itself looks good. But the game isn't there. It really isn't much to talk about. I mean, if you've played Tetris, then you've played Tetris. Blocks fall from the sky, and each of those blocks consists of basically, they're all made up of four squares, just rearranged in different shapes. Some of them are four squares, but, you know, arranged in an L shape. Some of them are just a straight beam a straight line, as they described it on the back so eloquently, a beam. And there's really not much else to talk about it in terms of that, other than that's what the gameplay is like. They descend from the top of the screen down to the bottom. You have to try. You can rotate them and move them to different locations, so that way it fits better. And once you complete a full row of those squares, by fitting the blocks together, then they disappear and you get points for it. And you progress through the levels by getting so many points. And that's essentially the whole gist of the game. Now, what Tetris lacks in terms of conversation about the game itself, I mean, it's fun, it's iconic, it put the Game Boy on the map. It's a very important game in terms of video game history, but there isn't really much to say in terms about the game itself, because it's a fairly simple, straightforward game. It's not like you can talk about different aspects, in Mario, we just finished Mario Month, you can talk about individual levels that you really liked. Tetris, every level's the same, it just moves a little bit faster. So maybe you can say what your favorite speed is, but that's not really saying much about a level. It's just saying something about what your skill level is, which mine's shit with this game, because I'm bad at puzzle games. But no, so the history of the game, though, is really fascinating. And it kind of started out unexpectedly. The developer of the game, his name is Alexey Pajitnov. Now, before I continue on with this, I want to preface it by saying a lot of the information here I got from the Gaming Historian YouTube video. If you guys have never watched the Video Game Historian on YouTube, go give his stuff a watch. It's really, really good. He does a lot of amazing research. I don't know where he finds all of his stuff, but he's a really good YouTuber, and I highly suggest checking him out. In any case, let's continue on. So it was the game was developed by a Russian programmer named Alexey Pajitnov. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. The inspiration from the game came from his love of a childhood game, and he grew up in, Russia, the Soviet Union, so there wasn't a whole lot of entertainment for children back then, because he was growing up at the height of the Cold War. This was the, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and I guess he probably grew up in the 60s and 70s. The game, I think, was originally released in 1984 in Russia, but eventually it made its way past the Iron Curtain over to the West. And so anyway, he kind of got the inspiration for the game from a childhood game called Tetrominoes. And it's Tetrominoes is pretty much, it's very similar to Tetris. It's a bunch of block shapes that you have to fit together. But as opposed to Tetris, where it's all falling from the sky, this is literally a physical puzzle game where you have these blocks made up of five squares in various shapes, similar to Tetris, but, you know, Tetris has four, but five squares, and you just have to fit it into this puzzle, into this frame, and there's only one way to do it. So he kind of, there's only one way to solve that puzzle, I mean. So he got the idea from that game, and he programmed, essentially, Tetrominoes for a computer. And it didn't really take too long for him to realize this wasn't going to be a fun game, because once you solve the puzzle, that's it. That's the game. There's nothing more to it. There's no replay value in that. And because of that, it led him to want to design something different. And so he decided to shrink the width of the screen, or the width of the box, elongate it so it, you know, fills the whole thing, go top, have them start falling from the sky, change it to four squares instead of five squares within each block, and you would have to bring it down. And he ran into another problem, they would fall down, you'd have to arrange them. But he ran into another problem right after that, is that the screen would fill up and then you'd be done. And so what made the next development made the game addictive. Once you complete a row, that's where you get the points, and it disappears. So now you're trying to see how many rows you can get all at once to disappear. And, you know, obviously the best goal would be to get a row of five to all disappear, since that's generally the highest you could get with, you know, the straight blocks. But I digress. So that's essentially how the game was designed, or that's how he made the game. Now, the game itself, you know, talking about his development of it, that's fine. I'm sure there's a little bit more to it than that, but that's not what I got from at least the gaming historian video, and it's not, I don't know if anyone would really know except for him. Believe it or not, though, he lives in Washington now. Which I thought was kind of interesting. Washington State, excuse me. And so anyway, he loved the game, but he couldn't really get anyone to play because the Russians had these shitty computers, and I really cannot remember the type of computer they were, but they were pretty shitty computers. And so he decided to get the help of this Russian whiz kid named Vadim Gerasimov. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. This kid was an insanely talented programmer, and he was like essentially a savant. This kid was ridiculously good at programming. And so he asked him, would you be able to port my game to an IBM PC? Because that was generally the standard for the rest of the world, just not behind the Iron Curtain in Russia. And the kid, Vadim, had never really worked with an IBM before, but in three days, he figured out how to port it. He figured out the hardware, and just, kid was a genius, like I said. So because of that, they started passing around on different floppy disks, not just for the original computer, but now also for IBM's. And eventually, just through word of mouth and through making copies, it's essentially like a really old version of shareware, because there was no internet, you couldn't just download it, and it's not like you could really sell a game in Russia, you know, with at the height of communism. And so he just gave it away for free, and, you know, people would start playing it, started to get addicted, and it made its way all the way out to Eastern Europe. And that's where a man named, Robert Stein discovered it. Robert Stein, he was originally from an Eastern European country. I cannot remember off the top of my head. It might be Austria or maybe Hungary, but I honestly can't remember. Once again, watch the gaming historian video on it. I'm kind of surmising all this, but he goes into a little bit more detail. In any case, so Robert Stein discovers it and is like, but he gets hooked on it. He realizes the amazing potential of this game. Now, Robert Stein's whole business model is that he would find games and then buy the rights to them and then license them to other companies to make it. And he would just take a cut. So he would get royalties. So essentially, he would buy from one developer. You'd buy the rights from one developer, buy the rights from the game from the creator, sell those rights to a publisher, and he would just get a cut of the money since he's the one that discovered it, essentially like a finder's fee. He'd get a royalty for every game sold. And he So he started trying to contact the Russians or Alexei, but he didn't know it was Alexei at the time, to get the game so he could get the rights to sell it, you know, in Europe and the UK. He loved it. So he was able to get in contact with Alexei somehow. And now Alexei probably wasn't really supposed to be talking to this guy because, you know, he's behind the Iron Curtain. It's not really dealing with the government or anything like that. But nonetheless, he still, you know, spoke to him, or he still was in contact with him. And Robert asked him, would you be willing to let me license it? Or would you be willing to sell the rights so I could, you know, get deals and publish this? Alexei couldn't say yes definitively, but he said that he was interested. Well, in Stein's mind, that verbal agreement was enough to go start seeking buyers. However, in Alexei's mind, he didn't want to shut the door because he really wanted this game to sell, but at the same time, he really couldn't do much about it because of everything going on in the Soviet Union. Well, Stein sold it. He started selling it. He was basically courting it to two different companies. The one company was Spectrum Holobyte, which was a U.S.-based company, and they were going to get the rights to port it to the PC in the U.S., or publish it, excuse me, in the PC, on the PC in the U.S., and then he also was in contact with a company called Mirrorsoft, which he was going to sell the rights to publish for the PC in the U.K. And everything was going somewhat swimmingly with that, but he still didn't have the actual contract signed by the Russians. And production was already starting, you know, he was waiting for a while and production already started to happen for these games. And so he kept trying to deal with Alexei, and eventually he actually worked for the government at the time developing speech recognition software for AIs, which is weird to think back in like the early 80s that there was speech recognition software. It's a little freaky actually, but they were working on it back then. And he got his company that, you know, the government agency that he worked for involved, and they kind of brokered a deal, and they just in the nick of time, right as they were about to sell, Stein was able to broker a deal with Alexei's agency, the government agency he worked for. And basically the rights said that the licensing agreement said that, you know, through Robert Stein, his company was called Andromeda, through Robert Stein, they could publish Tetris for various types of computers. And I mean that literally. It literally, a direct quote from that contract said, various types of computers. Now, in Robert Stein's mind, that meant consoles, not arcades, because that's not a computer in his mind, but consoles and computer and PCs. And that we'll come back to that later, but that actually has an important role to play, that little distinction. So Stein starts making it, and Tetris is selling crazy. They market it. They really laid into the Russian portion of that because, you know, that was exotic. No one knew what was going on behind the Iron Curtain. So that was their whole marketing spin to get everyone interesting. It's Russia. What's going on in Russia? We don't know. It's all a bunch of communists. And so they were trying to pretty much, I mean, it sold like hotcakes. Everyone loved it. Everyone wanted Tetris. It was one of the biggest and most popular games. So then it started getting the attention of, you know, people more than just the U.S. And, excuse me, it started getting the attention of people more than just the U.S. And Nintendo came along this guy named Hank Rogers from a company called Bulletproof Software, Hank Rogers, he was actually from, I want to say the Netherlands, but he ran a Japanese game developer. And so he discovered Tetris and wanted to bring it to Japan. He thought it'd be a huge hit. And so he contacts Spectrum Holobyte, the U.S. company that Robert Stein, the original guy, sold the rights to. And basically, there's a little bit more to it than this because they said, though, we can't sell you the console rights. Oh, sorry. Hank wanted the console rights for Japan. Sorry, this is a confusing mess. Hank wanted the console rights for Japan. Spectrum Holobyte in the U.S. said, we would love to because they would have gotten more money from it than but they had already sold it to Atari. And so Hank went to Atari, convinced them to sell it to him. And I forget what exactly they ended up buying it for or what they paid for it. But they ended up buying the console rights and started making Tetris in Japan. And once again, it was a huge success. Now, it was released for the Famicom. So it was in it was released in Japan first for the, you know, essentially the Nintendo, but not the US just yet, not for the console at least anyway. And so, yeah, so that's what was going on. Now, this is where everything starts to kind of crumble for at least a handful of the players in here. So let's kind of recap so far, because I know it's a little confusing. So Alexei Pajitnov develops Tetris. He gets a friend of his to port it to the IBM PC standard, so that way more people can find it and use it. Makes his way out to Eastern Europe. This dude named Robert Stein discovers it. He runs a company called Andromeda. Andromeda buys the rights for Tetris, and then they sell the PC and console rights to Mirasoft for the UK. So the console and PC rights only in the UK to Mirasoft. And the same deal, essentially, but only for the US, to Spectrum Holobyte. Then from Spectrum Holobyte, Hank Rogers' Bulletproof Software buys the Japanese console rights, which to be honest, it's not really quite well explained how that all worked, but that's kind of going along with what the vagueness of, to bring it back, that contract that I mentioned, how they literally just said, you have the license, you can publish Tetris for various kinds of computers. And that's what led to all this confusion. That's why it's so hard to follow who owned the rights to what with this. So, because Tetris was so popular, it wasn't long before people started knocking on Robert Stein's door as to, hey, can I have the handheld rights and can I have the arcade rights to this game? He didn't have them, though. He knew he didn't have them. So he went back to Russia and he started contacting them, only to find out that the whole time he was dealing with the wrong company. The company that brokered him that deal, that got him, it was legit. It was a legit contract, but he found out that he was actually supposed to be talking with this company named Elorg, and they were all confused as to why, you know, this was all happening. Now, I might have my timelines mixed up. Elorg might have come in before it was officially licensed all the way, but either way, at first he was dealing with Alexei's company, and then he ended up dealing with Elorg, which was the official government agency to deal with technology being imported or exported to different countries. So they end up brokering, I believe they might have actually brokered the initial deal, but it was still a mess nonetheless. And so he goes to contact them and ask about this, and they're just not having it because they have not received any payment that they were promised for the initial licensing rights. Yeah, maybe the upfront money they got, but in terms of the royalties they were promised, they didn't get any of it. And so understandably, they're pissed. So he can't get it, and this pretty much is what starts off the feeding frenzy. So he decides, so Robert Stein, you know, the original guy who brokered the whole contract, decides, I'm going to go to Russia and just smooth this all out. I'm sure it'll be fine. No big deal. But there's a lot of impatient other companies here. In fact, one of the companies that Stein already sold the rights to, Mirasoft in the UK, their parent company, Maxwell Corporation, which I know I haven't mentioned before, I don't know much about them, but that was their parent company. They decided, like, we don't want to wait either. We're just going to go to Russia. And they sent the CEO's son to broker a deal. And this is all, they're all being sent to Russia. They're all going to Russia around the same time. But that's not where it ends either. There's a third person going to Russia now, and that's Hank Rogers from Bulletproof Software over in Japan, who published Tetris for the Famicom in Japan. So though all three of these men are going over to, I believe, St. Petersburg, or no, sorry, Moscow, one of the two big cities in Russia, but they're going over there to broker the deal for themselves and just get it all worked out, no problems. So what ends up happening, there's a lot more to it. The timelines are a little hard to explain without having any kind of like visual examples, but which is once again why you should watch the Gaming Historian video. No, I don't know Norm. I don't know him personally, but seriously, give his stuff a watch. It's amazing. In any case, so what ends up basically happening? Hank Rogers makes it there first. The guy from Japan, the Bulletproof Software guy, Hank Rogers makes it there first. And he says flat out, can we, you know, well, he asks, can we license it? And he shows them their Tetris cartridge. And the Russian guy is confused. he doesn't understand. He's like, we only license this for computers, not console and not handhelds, not any of this stuff. And he was understandably pissed. He didn't understand why all this was happening and why they weren't seeing any cut of it. And so come back tomorrow with your original contract and let's work through this. So that's what Rogers does. He comes back with the contract and he points out to the Russians the exact line where all the confusion is happening. He shows them right there and then. It says various kinds of computers. So the Russians are understandably pretty annoyed by this. They now see where all this confusion is coming from, though. So, and they like Hank because he's been so straightforward with them compared to everyone else who's been kind of wheeling and dealing them. And so then the CEO's son of Microsoft or Maxwell Corporation comes over, and he basically is told, is like, well, we can't sell you any more rights right now. We're not interested in right now, but we'll give you first refusal rights on Tetris for any new licensing agreements that come up. And the Maxwell Corporation guy's like, yeah, it's a good idea. Like that's great. We'll be able to do this first off, because as far as they were aware, they had the console rights already, the console and PC rights. Then Robert Stein shows up and pretty much they drop the hammer on him. Not only they basically say we won't sign over any new rights unless you agree to revisions of this contract, which basically have harsher penalties for not paying the royalties that you promised us. So Stein has to look over it, and he literally can't get anywhere without signing this. The Russians played him a little bit, though. They snuck into the contract a definition of a computer, what specifically, in terms of that contract, they define as a computer. Stein signed the revision, and it was backdated to when it was initially signed, a couple months, a year or two ago. And so technically now he only has the PC rights, and that's it. He did end up brokering a deal for the arcade rights as well, but they wouldn't offer him the handheld rights. So he thinks he has console, PC, and arcade rights. Stein thinks he has that. The Microsoft guys from the UK think they have the PC and console rights locked up and first refusal for everything else. Right now Rogers doesn't really have anything, but as he comes back after all that's done and he's able to get the handheld rights from them for Nintendo, he brokers this for Nintendo, as well as after he gets the handheld rights, they're like, make an offer for the console rights. They're available now. So he literally brings over some of the heads of Nintendo and they broker a deal and get the console rights for Tetris, which is how we are all able to play it now. And Nintendo really liked this because they knew Atari thought they had the console rights in the US, and Nintendo and Atari famously really didn't get along too well during the late 80s and early 90s, which, for those who don't know, it's a huge topic and it's going to be very far off from what we're talking about here, but Atari worked under a shell company named Tengen at the time. And they made basically, not bootleg, but unlicensed Nintendo games. So Nintendo wasn't happy with Atari. And there's a whole story more than just what I said there. But so Nintendo wanted to dick over Atari, and this was the best way they could, by stealing, essentially, not stealing, but like just kind of yoinking the rights out from under them. And so in the end, everyone gets pissed except for Nintendo, because they ended up getting the handheld rights and the console rights to Tetris. Though Stein still had the PC rights as well as the arcade rights, but the damage was done. All the money was in handhelds and consoles, and that's essentially how we got it onto the Game Boy and how we got it onto the NES. Now, I missed a ton of information there. Like I said already, like a billion times, watch the Gaming Historian video. Hopefully I articulated this well enough where it makes sense. I did my best. I didn't want to work off a script, because I really hate that kind of scripty feel, unless it's something where I really like write up something or like write out a full thing, and it's something I'm really, really passionate about. And I like Tetris well enough, and I think the history is interesting, but I just kind of wanted to talk about it. I think it's an interesting story, but it's still, not 100% of my alley, but in any case, it's a really good story, and I definitely suggest watching the Gaming Historian video on it, because he will give a lot more information about it than I did. I just kind of, even though I'm looking at the time now and it's getting close to 20 minutes or so, or maybe over 20 minutes, I'm sorry. But it's a really fascinating story. I definitely suggest giving it a watch. So that about wraps up this episode of Still Loading. I'm kind of back to my normal running time, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. I'm hoping to actually eventually be able to, you know, talk to myself for more than 20 or 30 minutes, but it's a little hard to do. I feel kind of like a crazy person. But all right, so let's wrap it all up. Thank you all once again for listening. As usual, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you would like, you can reach out to me on via email, stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. I'd also like to give some shout-outs. Shout out to my friend Erica over at the Apex in the Abyss, one of my good podcasting buddies. She's been there from the beginning for me, and her podcast is amazing. If you like true crime stuff, please go consider listening to her show. It's truly fantastic. She's been on a bit of a hiatus lately, but she'll be coming back in September, so please go check it out. Get all hyped up for her next episode. Also, I'd love to give a shout out to Two Guys in a Game and the Hotter Show. Two Guys in a Game is a fellow gaming podcast. They're really funny. I'm serious, like, I wish I could be as funny as them. I guess I'm too dry in my deliveries. I don't know. But they're a really good podcast. I really suggest giving them a listen. Hotter and Kaz are the hosts, and they're fucking amazing. They're really funny. Hotter is also the host of his show, The Hotter Show, hence the other podcast. And that podcast is more of like a kind of like an interview, music review kind of show. It's kind of whatever he wants to talk about, but he's a very good host, and I definitely suggest giving him a listen. Shout outs to No Geeks Allowed. That's K-N-O-W, No Geeks Allowed. They're another awesome podcast. They kind of cover all kinds of geek culture and everything. Really funny as well. I, once again, like Two Guys in the Game, I wish I had that flair of comedic genius as these guys do. I think they're really funny. And speaking of comedy, another good podcast, Drinks with Larry, great comedy podcast. And Christian and Damon's Amazing Nerd Show, really solid like comic book and wrestling show. I know they do more than that. They cover horror movies and just movies in general, but you can usually tell what they're really big fans of. But they're great podcasters, and I definitely suggest go giving them a listen. And I think I got everything. I think that should wrap it up. So once again, all thank you again for listening, and I will see you all next time.